Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. We are finally back. Thank you so much for your patience in my absence over the past 3 months. I was dealing with some health issues that have mostly resolved, and I'm very happy to be back to bringing you interviews with our amazing guests. Today's guest is Kevin Case, who you may remember from his last appearance in season one. We thought it would be great to bring him back to talk about the current state of affairs in the orchestra world. Welcome back, and thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thanks, Joel. It's good to be back, and I'm glad you're back.
Yeah, thank you. Kevin Case is one of the most sought-after attorneys in our industry, as he represents musicians and artists nationwide in labor and employment matters, including the drafting and negotiation of collective bargaining agreements for many orchestras and individual employment contracts on behalf of symphony and opera musicians. Since 2015, he has served as general counsel to the International Conference of Symphony and Opera Musicians, which gives him a bird's-eye view of the entire industry. This is a great position to be in when it comes to serving as the player's attorney in so many orchestras. So how many orchestras are you currently working with, Kevin?
Over the last couple of years, I've worked with around 24, 25 orchestras on their contracts in some capacity. Sometimes that's a full-fledged sitting at the table for many hours negotiating. Other times it's working with a committee in the background as they negotiate. Yeah, it's about 24 orchestras, mostly Ixom, a couple of Europa orchestras. In any given year, it's not like all 24 I'm negotiating for at the same time, because it really depends on when the contracts expire. So usually it's like between 7 and 10 during a contract negotiation season, as it were. And well, they can be a little more specific about what that season is too, but that's generally how it works. The exception was during the pandemic when, especially early on, everybody was having to renegotiate their contracts. So yeah, it was well over 20 all at the same time for a while.
And oh, wow.
Now that was all over Zoom, which made it a little easier, no travel.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes I'll just plant my butt at my desk in the morning, turn on the Zoom camera, and get up at night.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like.
Have you returned to traveling back to orchestras in person now?
I have. I did all the negotiations in 2022 in person. The Zoom now has given us an effective tool to do some of the prep work, you know, remotely, which helps a little bit. But there really is no substitute for being in person.
Yeah.
Not only for the negotiation process, but for me to be working with the orchestra committee and to build a rapport with them and really be able to understand them and do an effective job for them. It really, really helps to be in the same room with them. There's something about Zoom that you don't quite get that.
Yeah. And then when you're negotiating and you have a lot of orchestras at once, let's say seven, what's the time period where that becomes the most busy that you have to start juggling them?
Yeah, so you kind of work backwards from when these contracts expire. So in the orchestra world, it's usually August and September are the contract expiration dates for just about everybody. So it kind of happens in two phases. There are orchestras that don't have summer seasons, and so they want to get their negotiations done before the summer. Even though the contract doesn't expire until the end of the summer, they want to get it done before. So with those orchestras, start in sometimes early January or February, to try to get those wrapped up. And then the ones that prefer to negotiate during the summer, or where you can't reach the agreement in the spring because sometimes the issues are too difficult for that, then it turns into a real busy August and September.
Yeah.
You know, so that's kind of like the progression of things. And then by November, things have settled, and that's kind of the quiet period where I wrap up all the CBA language if necessary, and then just deal with the other things that come up day to day in orchestras.
Okay, well, before we jump into really talking about some of those specific contracts, I'm curious, as things have slowly returned to normal, what kind of changes you've seen in orchestra contracts that started during the peak of COVID and have actually remained in contracts past the peak of COVID?
Not as many changes as I thought have become permanent. Well, let's step back and look at what we did during the pandemic in orchestras, because there were some specific things that just, that was how we had to operate. So streaming clearly was one of them. That was the only way to connect with patrons and donors if you couldn't do live performances in the hall. So streaming was a big component of that. Another component was the idea of musicians doing things other than playing their instruments. So interacting with donors, basically just calling them, writing thank you notes, doing virtual education sessions, you know, all sorts of like outside the normal zone of orchestral playing. And then the third component is kind of relates to that a little bit, but in using smaller ensembles for things, which was necessary during the pandemic, of course, because this couldn't fit everybody on stage with all the distancing. And also some outreach that some orchestras were doing during the pandemic, really going out into the community and trying to play places instead of trying to pack everybody into the hall. So of those three things, some have continued in some way and some haven't. So the streaming has not become a permanent feature, except in a couple of orchestras. So for instance, your orchestra, the Atlanta Symphony, has a really robust and really excellent streaming platform. I mean, it's very sophisticated. It's good.
That's good.
Other orchestras like Detroit had it long before the pandemic. So, you know, there those that have these kind of robust streaming systems in place are continuing them. But those that just kind of cobbled it together out of necessity during the pandemic are really not continuing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's pretty easy to see why. They're not big money makers. Right. It's hard to really get anybody to pay for a stream online, certainly not the equivalent of a ticket.
Yeah.
And the other thing, and to me, this is more important. We want to emphasize live music. You know, our mission is to play as orchestral musicians. I still consider myself one is to play this great music for people in a hall. And you just don't get that experience on streaming. And we all really want to and need to emphasize the importance of live music as much as possible. So most orchestras are really turning their efforts to bringing people back into the hall. So that part is not really continuing the way it was set up during the pandemic. Similarly, kind of the idea of musicians doing kind of extracurricular activities, that was happening before the pandemic to some extent, because every orchestra has musicians who are good at talking to people and are good at kind of being an evangelist for the orchestra and letting people just know what it's all about. Those people are still doing it.
Yeah.
Maybe we picked up a few more, but it's not something that, okay, this is now your mandatory part of your job or you have to sit down with your donor list and call everybody. That's not happening. But there are people who are really interested in it. And I would have to say, I think it's really effective. Uh-huh. I think patrons and donors want to see and interact with musicians. So if you have musicians who are good at that and are willing, I mean, that's an incredible resource. It really can help the organization. So that's continuing on a voluntary basis. And really the same thing with the small ensembles. During the kind of the shutdown period, everybody had to do something. And the problem with the small ensembles and making those a mandatory part of your job is one of equity. You know, some people are more comfortable than others in a small ensemble setting playing one on a part. Others are more effective at that, shall we say, than some. So what ends up happening is the people who are good at it and comfortable doing it are going to do it all. And people who aren't won't. So there's a real imbalance in the workload.
Yeah.
I've been racking my brain to try to find a way to even that out somehow. And I just haven't come up with one. I mean, a lot of the agreements in the last couple of years had language like the employer will make best efforts to equitably allocate the workload among people. And yeah, I mean, that's great language, but in practice, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's been a realization across the industry that that's the case. So all of this kind of small ensemble work and community engagement with ensembles, it really has remained voluntary and is compensated extra in some way, either with a per service rate of some kind or with extra time off. Some of those programs have been in place for a while where you do a certain amount of activities and you get some vacation days or something like that.
Yep.
But so those twin concepts of it being voluntary and receiving some kind of extra compensation, that is where we've ended up. So it did not turn into a mandatory part of a musician's job duties, which it could have gone that way during the pandemic, but it hasn't.
Was that something you were concerned about when you were looking at all these agreements in the middle of the pandemic?
I was. You know, there were a lot of things that the musicians had to go out of their comfort zone to agree to out of necessity, and that was one of them. And I was concerned that that could be a permanent feature where employers would really want that to be a mandatory part of everybody's job. And that's problematic because that wasn't what they signed up for.
Yeah.
That wasn't the job that they auditioned for or hired for. Like I say, some like to do it, some are better at it than others, but to make that mandatory, that was concerning to me. And like I say, fortunately, I think most employers, at least the ones that I've worked with, have recognized that that's not really workable. So they're keeping it as a voluntary endeavor. And it's an important endeavor. I mean, really, especially outreach into the community. It's crucial for orchestras to do it. You know, so finding the best way to, and most effective way to do it is important.
Yeah. And I mean, you want to have your best people who do it best out there in the community,
right,
instead of people who are begrudgingly out there. And actually, yeah, it's interesting because the two out of the three things you mentioned are a pretty big part of the job in Atlanta. So we have a very robust outreach program.
Yep.
So we can go into small groups and go into schools and do different things to reach out to the community. And we trade that for specific time off requirements. So we get a little extra time off if we do that. And then the other thing is getting involved in some of the development things, meeting with different supporters, taking part in different events. All of that is available for us to volunteer for. And the people who want to do it can do it. And the people who don't want to don't have to. And I like that solution because I'd be happy to go out and meet with donors and talk about how great it is to play our music and be in an orchestra and to continue to try and hopefully get their support moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I say, that's who a lot of people want to see are the musicians. So it can be a very effective tool.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the current state of affairs in the orchestra world. Can you highlight the most notable contract settlements? I mean, are things trending in a positive or negative direction overall? And which contracts really highlight where we are now that the worst of COVID is behind us, at least as far as the industry is concerned with COVID?
Yeah. Well, I've been thinking about this sort of like big picture overview of the last year of bargaining, and it seems like the contract settlements have fallen into two camps. There are some orchestras that are very confident about the future. Their financial condition is good. They are not, well, they can be concerned about how audiences return to the halls, but they're confident that they can make it happen. In one negotiation, one CEO said my favorite comment. She said, "Are we worried that people are going to be slow to come back? Yeah. So we're just going to make sure that doesn't happen."
I like that.
It's just like, yeah, we're just going to make it work.
Yeah.
And have a plan rather than be, oh, we're so worried. But the ones that are the most confident about the future were willing to enter into long-term agreements with their musicians that were pretty progressive. So the Atlanta Symphony was one. It was a nice progressive three-year agreement with some healthy compensation raises in it. The Florida Orchestra also had a nice three-year agreement. San Diego had a two-year agreement with some large increases for the musicians. And a lot of this was absolutely necessary because of inflation, right? I mean, it's been killing everybody. And in certain areas, I just mentioned San Diego. To try to buy a house there, it's just insane. So,
yeah,
a lot of these increases were kind of long overdue. There are also some orchestras, maybe they weren't massive raises or anything, but they were places that had been in trouble in the past and now have gotten on a good path. So I'm thinking like Charlotte, which was an orchestra that I lost sleep over for many, many years because it just seemed they were always on the brink. Mm-hmm. And they seemed to be in a pretty healthy spot, and they had a nice two-year agreement there. Fort Worth, we have a three-year agreement there with some nice elements to it. And if you think back a few years, that was a a horrible situation in terms of the labor management relationship.
Yeah.
There was a long and kind of ugly strike, and it was bad. And now the negotiations were quite amicable and friendly and cooperative, and we got a good agreement out of it. So in these places where people are relatively confident that they can get back to the business of presenting orchestras, the agreements follow. The second category, though, are situations with a lot more trepidation, and those have ended up being one-year agreements.
Okay.
Because from the employer's perspective, okay, look at all this uncertainty. You know, we don't know how audiences are going to return. We don't know what's going on with the economy. We've got all this inflation, and we have the Fed raising interest rates. That's going to cause a recession. Will it? We don't know, but uncertainty. The war in Ukraine, uncertainty. And of course, the pandemic's not over.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, what's going to happen with that? I mean, we seem to be managing to live our lives, but you never know what's going to happen with that. So in the face of all that uncertainty, I think a lot of employers are saying, look, short term, that's all we can do. And if that's the case, I mean, that's what you kind of have to do, because you can't force a long-term agreement if the employer doesn't want to go there. And if you try, you're just going to see really horrible offers for long-term agreements.
Yeah.
So if a one-year is what they can do, you work to get the one-year as healthy as possible. And that was that kind of second category of agreements, where 1 year with compensation increases, sometimes a cash bonus to help offset inflationary pressures. But overall, fairly positive economic results. And I think it's really important to point to some of the reasons why, because the irony of this whole thing is that orchestras as a whole came out of the pandemic in better financial shape than when they went in. Hmm. I mean, there were a lot of factors at work there. Donors really stepped up during those couple of years. Musicians took pay cuts to help the organization. But the big kahuna was the federal aid.
Yeah.
The multiple rounds of the Paycheck Protection Funding, then particularly the SVOG, Shuttered Venue Operators Grants. And there ended up being two rounds of that. Hmm. And then the Employee Retention Tax Credit. I mean, there was a massive amount of federal aid that gave orchestras, you know, the ability to not only withstand the loss of revenue during the pandemic closures, but really you help them build up reserves and give them a cushion to go forward.
Yeah.
And I think actually it's relevant considering, you know, you have your Georgia runoff election tomorrow. The only reason that orchestras got this federal aid was because of the runoff election in Georgia in January of 2021.
Right. Yeah, that's
because
true.
If Ossoff and Warnock had not won those races, the Senate would not have flipped to the Democrats, and none of this aid would have happened. It's safe to say that those large amounts of aids after the Biden administration took office, that was made possible by having control of the Senate, period.
Wow.
And, you know, help with the AFM pension, everything. So bottom line, this entire industry owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to the voters of your state.
Well, so hopefully we can deliver again, not to give up my politics here, but
that's... Yeah, well, hopefully we'll be thankful after tomorrow as well.
I mean, I remember, what was it, 20, 25 years ago when orchestras were really reliant on federal aid, and mm-hmm. then that started to get trimmed down, and then a lot of orchestras started to have big problems because they had gotten used to it. And this wasn't like that. This was helping the organizations that really needed it in a great time of need. And you have to wonder how many organizations would have literally failed without it.
I think quite a few. I was worried in the spring of 2020 that I was going to have to really bone up on my bankruptcy law. Boy, I was worried. And that first round of Paycheck Protection Funding made things a lot better. And then, like I say, when Congress flipped, the rest of those rounds of federal aid made such a difference.
Yeah, that's really something. Are there any orchestra contracts that you saw this fall that surprised you, did some unusual things that you haven't seen in a while?
Well, the ones that I worked with didn't really do anything groundbreaking. In fact, kind of the somewhat surprising aspect of my negotiations was just how normal they were. Uh-huh. You know, just like business as usual in terms of what the issues were and how to deal with it. It was fairly traditional. Now, there were a couple that I didn't work with, I think, that had some more radical changes. I know the Cincinnati Symphony agreed to a new system, really, of the hours that they work and how they're calculated and how they're assigned. So that was definitely a groundbreaking agreement in many ways, but it's a new agreement, so we have to see how that works out. Mm-hmm. I really just kind of redid the structure of things. But essentially, I mean, there wasn't anything revolutionary in this last round of bargaining. And I think that is a good sign because revolutions are not always a good thing in an industry like this.
Yeah, that's true. Staying the course has worked pretty well for many decades, although not necessarily in programming and other things. I don't mean it that way. We've seen a lot of changes in that area, which I think have been necessary.
Yeah, and that's a good point because that brings up the whole DEI initiative. If there is one thing that is now more important than it has been in the past is to try to adhere to some best practices in that arena. So, for instance, the use of audition screens through the entire process. You know, it's been trending that way, kind of slowly. But I would say maybe 20 years ago, a lot of people took their screens down after the first round.
Yeah.
And gradually, more and more orchestras were starting to keep them up through the whole process. And then that really got jump-started. So in the last couple of years, it's just like this inexorable tide towards orchestras keeping the screens up through the entire audition round. And while in the past that had been kind of controversial in orchestras, you know, I mean, the reasonable minds can disagree on this, right? But, you know, there's the school of thought that says, well, we really need to see how somebody plays and how they interact and all of that. But, you know, countering that is the fact that that opens up the door for bias, even a totally unconscious bias.
Yeah.
And there's greater recognition that that's a concern. That's a real concern, and it outweighs the concern of being able to see somebody play. So more and more orchestras have done that. Sometimes it's not easy. The obstacle is usually the music director, to be frank about it. Music directors really do want to see people play, because that's their job when they're up on the podium. That's what they're doing. And so they want to be able to see it. But they often strongly resist the idea of totally blind auditions. And sometimes their management goes along with that and says, no, sorry, we're not going to agree to keep the screens up. And sometimes they're willing to overrule their music director and say, look, no, this is something we have to do now.
Yeah.
That's been something that's moving in a really particular direction.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it actually took me a while to get on board with the idea of keeping screens up the whole time, because I had been used to it through my experience of the screen came down in the finals and feeling like you do need to see the player. But I think that there's a concern from the musicians that there'd be pressure to hire in a specific manner if the screen does come down. So I think a lot of the musicians have changed their mind about keeping the screen up just to protect the integrity of the process. The other challenge, and I've talked about this at length on many other podcast episodes, is that a lot of times you can't even track who the player is from round to round. So you're listening to a player for 20 minutes and deciding whether to give them a job for the next potentially 2 years. And that's the other challenge with keeping them up. But we've gotten around that by having trial weeks. And of course, then people say, well, that's where the bias and well, really prejudice can come in. But at the same time, you have to make sure you can sit on a stand with somebody and that they are capable and competent at playing the repertoire, because you have to start doing that from day one. So I can see it from both sides too, but I think it's the right move, in my opinion.
It is. And when it comes to trial weeks, you know, I mean, I think there's a lot of traction to the arguments that those can be dangerous, because you know, here you have a almost overwhelmingly white organization, and maybe you have a person of color who's joining the organization. And if the goal of the trial week is to see how they fit in, that's problematic, because you're basically saying, okay, you have to be white, right? I mean, let's put it bluntly, you know? So there's no way to legislate around that with contract language. What it requires is a thinking change. And this would apply to the tenure process as well, because the tenure process is really like an extended trial.
Yeah.
And, you know, we often have fallen into that trap of thinking, well, it's all about how they fit in. Well, a shift in thinking as to, okay, what can this person contribute is a better way to look at it. You know, obviously they still have to fit into a degree. This is an orchestra. It has to work together. You can't have somebody who doesn't blend with their sound or doesn't play with everybody else. But, you know, if they have a particular sound that maybe is a little different but is appealing, well, okay, that adds to the group.
Yeah.
You know, that can change the group in possibly a better way, depending on the position and depending on, you know, how much of a difference there is. So really focusing on what the person can add rather on how they can be assimilated is, I think, a better mindset.
Yeah.
So there's no way to do contract language to make that happen. It requires us, you know, really working on it as individuals.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can see that argument. But again, I don't want to hire somebody on 20 minutes of knowledge. That's just not enough time to make that determination, hard. In my opinion. And that's part of the challenge here with both of those arguments is how do you make that work?
Well, and that's always been a problem with the audition process in orchestras. It's like, I think it was that quote about Churchill and democracy, you know, the worst one except for all the others. That's what our audition process is. There are problems with it. There have always been problems with it. And you've hit on it. You know, you're asking to make a decision about somebody's possible future career with the orchestra based on a few minutes.
Yeah.
But it's still the best one that we can come up with.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not ideal, but it's better than alternatives.
Yeah, I agree. Well, for those of you who don't know, Kevin and I met at my first job when I was principal cellist of the Memphis Symphony, and he was the concertmaster. So given the fact that you have now seen life as a professional violinist and an attorney who works completely in the classical world that you, well, sort of mostly left behind, what kind of advice can you offer to members of our audience who may be considering a career in music or even the law?
Yeah, well, so it's worthwhile to really know what you're getting into. Okay, so now I've done both. You know, I was a full-time orchestral musician for about a dozen years. And I've been a lawyer for a little longer than that. It kind of flew by. But having done both, you know, I can see the advantages and disadvantages. And, you know, the grass is always going to be greener on the other side. So when I was a musician, I missed the ability to use my brain and certain parts of my personality the way I can do in the law, kind of an analytic view of things. The ability to express myself verbally, to think hard and construct arguments, just a whole different part of my brain. I wasn't able to do that as an orchestral musician. That just the opportunity for that wasn't there. But then the flip side of it, being a lawyer, I can indulge that part of it. Well, there are times where I really miss the playing part because as difficult as it is to make a living as a musician, it is really gratifying to be able to play this music at a high level with other people at a high level. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it, which is why I still do it as much as I can. You know, but you just have to kind of be aware that, okay, you're going to have some things in, if you go in this direction and some things if you go in the other direction. Now, you can counter that somehow, and I probably could have done this more as a musician. You can be more than just a musician. So I see a lot of musicians, especially younger musicians, who are starting nonprofits and, you know, building, you know, their own ensembles and or music schools or something. And so they're kind of scratching that entrepreneurial itch at the same time they're playing music. So that can be effective. You're basically just using different parts of yourself that you want to use. As a lawyer, it's a little harder, depending on what kind of law you practice. Before I did this, I was an associate at a large litigation firm in Chicago. And I mean, that really does require pretty much 100% of your attention and time. I was not able to do a whole lot of playing during those years. Now, with my own practice, I have more flexibility and I can, you know, do some more performing. But that's not the norm as a lawyer. I kind of got fortunate to build this particular practice in this niche. Usually being a lawyer is a full-time job. There's not a whole lot of time for outside things.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question then. So when you worked for a big firm or was a big litigation firm, was that your original plan or was it, let me get some experience under my belt and then what I really want to do is work with musicians because I know that world so well? Yeah. How did that come about?
I wish I could say it was planned out like that. But I kind of did everything wrong when I went to law school because ideally when you go to law school, it's like you make your mind, you want to be a lawyer. This is it. And you go through all the steps. You know, you prep for the LSAT. You put in your applications, you put your nose to the grindstone, you know exactly what area of law you want to work in, and you push for that. I didn't do any of that. You know, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try this. So, you know, I kind of like took the LSAT without preparing much for it, you know, and I, you know, put my applications out there, and I probably could have applied to a lot more schools. And then when I got to law school, I had had experience in labor law from my time being on an orchestra committee and negotiating contracts, but I didn't have it in my head like, yes, I'm going to do this. Basically, it's like, I want to see what interests me. Uh-huh. And so I took a variety of different kind of classes in law school, looked at a bunch of different things. And the good part about being a litigator at a big firm is you get to just work in many different areas of the law.
Yeah.
And see something that appeals to you. And there were certainly those things. I actually really got into securities regulation and financial services law, because that's a lot of the work I was doing at my old firm. And it really does interest me a lot. It still interests me. But it became clear that what I really wanted to do was go back to my roots. And it took me a while to get there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I had that plan, but it pulled me back. So that's where I ended up. Again, the way I did things is really not the way you're supposed to do them. But, you know, I managed to make it work.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for all of this information on where things stand today and a little bit of a look into the industry and contracts. Do you feel like there's anything else that you might have wanted to say today and offer to our audience that we might have missed?
Just to follow up on a point I was making earlier about live music. I think the last couple of years really have highlighted the need for live performance in a way that is more significantly than we thought before. We always said that, right? You know, yeah, live performance is key. But no, it really, really is. And I think all of us in the industry, management, musicians, board members, have to like be evangelists for this because it's something that can easily slip through the cracks in today's oversaturated media environment with so many different options. But there really is nothing like live music, and we have to hammer that point home as often as we possibly can and as strongly as we possibly can.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me here again. Always good to see you.
Thank you so much to Kevin Case for giving us an update on the state of orchestra contracts, and thank you for sticking with us after a long absence and listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. I also want to wish a happy birthday to one of our very loyal listeners with the initials YS. You know who you are. If you're looking for more information on Kevin Case, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Wick Simmons, a cellist who spent last year touring with the 10-time Tony Award-winning Broadway show, The Band's Visit, as one of the 5 onstage musicians. We're here to serve you. So if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us at thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.